evening. I asked Inez yesterday what I should do tonight here. I was thinking maybe it was time to do questions. Just to, we haven't done that for a long time, and just have an open time for questions. She said, "Oh no, give a talk on how to sustain practice over the long term." And so I thought, well, so I was thinking about that today, and then I thought, well, I think I better maybe give a talk on Inez's idea, because if I ask for questions, she'll ask me that question. So I thought about it today and have some thoughts about the topic, but she's not here. How is it that someone sustains any spiritual practice, but how does one sustain a Buddhist practice or meditation practice over the long term? It reminds me of the kind of little cliche or joke about mindfulness practice, where it said that mindfulness practice is quite easy. What's difficult is remembering to do it. The easy part is just kind of being attentive and noticing what's happening now. But it's not so easy just to show up and pay attention to what's happening now. So the idea of how is it one sustains a practice, nourishes, maintains it, keeps it going over a long term, a long time. I think it's an issue which faces a lot of people, especially people who live lay lives, lay urban lives with work and family and responsibilities. And there's so many pulls and pushes on our time and on our interests and efforts. And it can be quite hard to sustain a practice, to sit every day or to keep it going for a long period of time. At one point today, while I was thinking about this topic, I thought, oh, I kind of smiled to myself thinking, oh, Inez basically wants me to give away, or she's kind of pointing to, one of the secrets of this kind of practice. One of the keys, one of the keys of how mindfulness practice or meditation practice works. And it's one of these secrets that we don't say very often. It's an open secret, right? And some of you might be new here the first time today, and I don't know if you're ready for this, the secret teaching. So the one of the real secrets about practice and how it works and how it develops over time is continuity. So to maintain the continuity of practice over time, whether it's to sit every day, day after day, or to have a continuity and bring mindfulness to your daily life, continuity of whatever way you practice, whatever your practice might be, to do it, to have the continuity, have repetition, do it over and over again, to practice. So how does one do that? What sustains that? What keeps it going? And when I thought about this today, I thought about it in the terms of that there are many variables. And the way these variables work, you don't have to have all of them. And you don't need to have them all strong. You need to have one of them or some of them strong enough to be good enough, to do enough. So it's kind of like if there's a 5-foot chasm you have to jump over. And so several variables need to kind of be in place to kind of allow for you to jump over there. So for example, you need a certain amount of strength in your legs. You need a certain amount of running space ahead to be able to jump far enough, get enough speed going. And you need to have a certain level of confidence that you can do it. And say that each of those, each of those, you could give them a number, a value number, how strong they are. And you have to get up to 10. If you get 10, then you're strong enough, you can manage to get over that 5-foot chasm. So it doesn't matter how you get to 10. So if you have 9 parts strength in your legs, and 1 part, a little bit of running distance, maybe you don't need any confidence at all. You have enough, you've got the 10. But if you get, you know, you might get 3 parts strength and 3 parts running distance, and then you better have 4 parts confidence, or you're not going to make it. Or you have 9 parts confidence. Maybe 9 parts confidence is enough, and 1 part strength is enough. Or maybe you don't need any strength at all if you have enough speed. So the variables in what sustains and maintains a spiritual practice over a long time is kind of like that. There's all these different variables, and for different people at different times, different ones of them are strong, different ones of them are enough to get you up to 10 or whatever the number is to maintain the practice. So I'm going to give you a list of variables for spiritual life, spiritual practice. And as I give them to you, you might listen about which of these is your strength, which of these kind of works for you the strongest or is present for you. Listen and see which of them might be the weakest for you. And see which of them maybe you can strengthen, you can work on. Which of them you might as well just forget because it's not your cup of tea. And just see kind of where it fits for you and how it works. The first two I'll list together because it's kind of a little bit clear to me, a little bit how they work together or how they kind of add up together. The first one is intention, and the second is having time. So what sustains practice over the long term? If you have strong intention, strong motivation, then nothing will get in the way, your way. You'll just do it. Your motivation will be there, and you'll get up in the morning and sit, or you'll apply yourself in practice, and whatever way practice means for you, you'll be motivated, you'll do it. The other is having the time. If people have a lot of time, they don't need to be very motivated. they have to have some motivation, of course, right? But if you have a lot of time, you're retired or who knows what the reason is, and you don't have a lot of projects and a lot of things you're doing and a lot of busyness and live a quiet life, and practicing, it's such a great thing, so easy, I just roll out of bed, I sit, I make breakfast, I come back and I sit, I clean up after breakfast and then I sit, and not much is going on, right? And you don't have to be so motivated, just what's happening. And whereas if you have very little time, then the issue of motivation becomes really strong. Is your motivation and intention strong enough to sustain the practice given all the other things that you're motivated to do or the other obligations or demands on your time? And I would say for people who are really busy or have a lot of projects or a lot of ideas what they want to do, it's really important to look at not just your intention to practice, but the intention for your life. What are the most sustaining, the important intentions that you want to base your life on? And then prioritize a little bit or look more carefully and see what is it that's really doable and workable. If you have too many things going, you won't do any of it well. And if you want to receive some benefit from a spiritual life, you maybe need to do it well in some way. You could be a weekend Buddhist, and that's very nice. No one's going to knock you for doing that. But if you just do it on the weekends or do it, once every great while, you do a little bit of practice. The practice is not really going to sustain you in times of, for example, times of great crisis and difficulty. When a difficulty arises in your life, like you get sick or you're dying, whatever crisis it might be, it really helps to have built up some momentum in practice, some stability, some ability to get concentrated, some strength of patience, some compassion, some skills with working with one's mind and hearts so that we're not completely derailed in the time of crisis. It's a little bit of sometimes people come to me in times of crisis and I'll offer what advice I can, but it's a whole different discussion with a person if the person has had a strong meditation practice leading up to that, leading up, is that the right word? Leading, prior to that time of crisis. They have some resources then that a person who doesn't have a practice doesn't have. So, you know, the more busy the life is, the more important intention is. And do you have the intention to practice when you're tired then? Or do you have the intention to give a little extra time that it needs to kind of make it work? Or do you have the intention to simplify your life a little bit, to make the space and time for meditation practice or for whatever the spiritual practice you're doing? I've known people who have wanted it all and then wanted to add spiritual life on top of that. You know, there's kind of like, you know, to be, yeah, just, you know, just what people want it all. There's a lot of wonderful things to do in life and wonderful things to attain and get and have. And one human being can't have it all. All the things that are promised to us are dangled in front of us like carrots by consumer culture and popular culture. Is not possible for any, you know, one human being to do. So there has to be some choices that we have to make. And looking at our intentions and making choices and having a sense of purpose for our life is part of that sustains practice. If we're not being realistic about the practice and what we can do, then I think it's all too easy to get discouraged. So then the second one is time, having the time. And I think it's actually very important. There's something happens to the heart or the mind or the inner psyche, the spiritual psyche, when there's time for it to unfold. I like to think of the kind of the spiritual core of our being as being something that's often quite shy. And it doesn't really show itself unless we have the time to it to kind of bubble up and show itself and kind of peep out and kind of get activated. I like to think of the kind of the spiritual side of human growth as being very inefficient, phenomenally inefficient, especially in the beginning. And for people who want to be efficient, it's just a drag. Because, you know, it'd be nice to just sit down, close your eyes, and enter into a one-pointed samadhi, just like that. Wouldn't that be good? I mean, that would be efficient, right? You can get it done with. And you know, I've heard people tell me things like, you know, I really want to get enlightened so I can get on with my life. I have a lot of things to do. Places to get, people to meet. Let's get this enlightenment over quickly. But, you know, unfortunately, I think that for the efficiency kind of approach to life, that spiritual, especially, it's best to think of spiritual life as being inefficient. So we're be sure to give ourselves lots of time, lots of redundant time, lots of repetition, lots of hanging in there, lots of kind of making open space for something to show itself and open space for us to unwind. A good part of a meditation life, Buddhist life, has to do with unwinding ourselves from being wound up. And unwinding need time for that. So what sustains practice over the long term is ensuring that we give ourselves time for it, open time, possible times, a little bit spacious time. I think it's not a foreign idea to a lot of religions. A lot of religions have the idea of a Sabbath. And I love the idea of a Sabbath, you know. And some religions have this idea of, you know, on the Sabbath you don't do anything, you don't work. And it kind of ensures, protects you from all the different ways that our society tells us we have to do and accomplish and get something. I think it's really wise to do something like a Sabbath. So come to the one day sitting on Saturday. Mm-hmm. You know, come and do nothing for a day. Another thing that sustains practice is faith and inspiration. Confidence. Some people are allergic to the word faith, and if that's the kind of person you are, then listen to the other variables and make sure they're strong enough. Some people have a lot of faith, and it can carry people really far. I'm really amazed at the strength of faith that some people have that sustains them through times of great difficulty. Any spiritual life, spiritual practice that's worth its grain of salt, or worth its valuable, will present the person with times of tremendous challenge and difficulty. And so what is it that sustains you through the lows, the periods of discouragement, the lows, the dark nights of the soul periods of practice? And one of those things is faith, or confidence, or inspiration. And that can be some real inspiration in what's possible, where the path is going. Some real inspiration in the value of what you're doing. Some real faith in what the teachings are. Some real faith in the exemplars of the teaching, those people who've gone really far and matured in the practice. I have a lot of faith in that person. And I don't know about this, but that person, you know, gives me a lot of confidence. I'm going to hang in there because of what I've seen in this person. If that person could have done that, then maybe I could do too. It's a path that's worthwhile to follow. And there are many sources for faith and inspiration. Occasionally, some people have too much of it, and that's a problem. But faith is a very important thing, sustains. And so if a person has trouble sustaining a practice over a long term, they might look at their inspiration and the faith. You really have faith. And you can turn this question upside down. And you can ask, if you don't have a lot of faith in the practice you want to pursue, then you can ask the question, what is it you really have faith in? And chances are that you have faith in something else. Some people have faith in making money, and that's where they put their faith in. Some people have a tremendous faith in, you know, owning a house or a career or in relationships, and that's where they put a lot of emphasis, their life, kind of in making certain things work or succeed, or they believe it's really going to be where their happiness is going to come from. Part of this sustainability project is to really look at what we deeply believe and evaluate, is it really realistic? Is it really going to provide the kind of happiness that I can depend on, or that's useful in the long term? And if not, is there something else which is more reliable, more helpful? And I would hope that if someone is involved in the spiritual life, has some inkling at least that the spiritual life points to some kind of very deep, reliable form of well-being, happiness, peace, that is independent from the conditions of the world. If we're always looking for the conditions of the world to provide us with peace and well-being, then it's a setup to probably be disappointed at some point. But if we can learn to find a sense of well-being and peace that's not dependent on the conditions of the world, then it's a whole different game, what life is about. So related to this thing of faith and inspiration is to have a clear sense of the importance of the spiritual practice that you're undertaking. So that requires, that partly maybe comes from study, from listening to talks, partly from your own experience of practicing, but to really understand this importance. And maybe it's importance for you personally, maybe importance for your family. Some people practice for their family's sake, the sake of their children, to create a better world. Or maybe a sense of importance for the world we live in. It's happening every generation, but there's the world goes through tremendous crisis, tremendous difficulty, suffering and pain and war. And I think it's a tremendous gift to the world to have people who can overcome their hate, their greed, their confusion, so that we can go into the world with kindness, love, compassion, generosity, and wisdom. I can't think of anything better. And so it's so important that some people do that. We had some people from our sitting group here go sit a 3-month retreat right after 9/11. They left maybe a week or 2 weeks after 9/11 to go sit this 3-month retreat. And I made a point to go up to them before they left and said, some people might have some doubts about going in this kind of reclusive, silent, long-term retreat in contrast to the tremendous horror and crisis of 9/11 in this country. Maybe we should stay, somehow get involved and stay involved in politics or do something, defend the homeland, or I don't know what. Should we stay here? And I said, I want to reassure you that I think that one of the most powerful responses to 9/11 is for some people to go and clarify their own hearts. If no one did that, clarify their hearts, then I would feel I kind of lose hope. But the fact that some people are able to kind of do that deep, deep work and really get into the roots of greed and hate and delusion in their own minds, then there's hope for everybody. And so I feel I want to encourage that this is a really a fantastic response. It's really important that people do this. Someone does it. So a clear sense of the importance, and there's two sides of this importance. One is could be said more positive, and one is more negative. The positive one is a very clear sense of the benefit and the possibility from a spiritual life. And the benefits can be long-term, and the benefits hopefully are immediate. It's not so uncommon for me to meet someone who has done a lot of practice, been in a lot of retreats, and whose practice was directed towards attaining some enlightenment. And after some years of practicing, the enlightenment they were pursuing didn't happen. And then they felt angry with all their years of practice. They felt angry with their teachers. They felt angry, just angry, upset. They felt discouraged, disappointed, depressed. I did all this work and nothing happened. My most common response to that is to ask them if they find any value in one moment of mindfulness. Independent of getting enlightened, was it valuable to be mindful and attentive, be present for your life as it is right now? And so far, none of them have disappointed me, the people. They've always said, oh no, one moment of mindfulness, I know the value of that. And I say, isn't that enough? Because if you're really mindful of the present moment, I think there's a kind of freedom there. There's a kind of a joy there. There's a kind of peace that's there. Just this moment, know what it is. Live it. Be present. Sense of immediacy. So to have a sense of the possibility and benefit of practice, I think it's really important to have a sense of its benefits in the immediate present. And people who are engaged in mindfulness practice, to really study this issue carefully and see, can you find a benefit of mindfulness practice where the reward happens instantaneous with the practice? The goal, the means and the goal are the same, are attained at the same time. Because if you can find that sense of immediacy and value in the immediacy of presence right here, then you might hopefully have a sense, well, this is good enough, or this was valuable in and of itself. You won't be disappointed in having done that effort, even if you don't get enlightened. Or as Suzuki Roshi once said, if your practice is sincere, it's almost as good as getting enlightened. If you have that sense. Both are possible. Having a sense of the benefits of the present moment, the immediacy of practice, and the possibility of some kind of opening realization experience down the line. But to experience the benefits of it and have a sense that you're moving towards something beautiful, something marvelous. Sometimes spiritual practice, meditation practice, for some people can be like falling in love, where it just you sit and there's kind of this sense of wonderful opening, heartfelt opening, sense of joy, sense of kind of inspiration that just comes from sitting down and opening up and being present. And it feels like you're moving into something really wonderful. The sense of that direction, the benefit is so obvious. Sometimes there's a vision that people have of what's possible. They sense, how much they're suffering now, and they have a vision that it's possible to be free of the suffering. And so they see that possibility that, and they feel how important it is to do that work. That's kind of the positive sense of the importance of it. The negative side of the understanding the importance of practice is to have a clear sense of danger. The danger of not practicing. And for some people, this works really well. They've lived a life which has been very, very difficult. For example, maybe they've been addicts of some form or other. And they see if they're not really practice, they don't practice really carefully and diligently, that they'll fall back into the old habits. And for some people, it's a matter of life and death. I've known people for whom it's a matter of life and death whether they practiced or not. And if they didn't practice, their old habits would take over and they would just slide right down. And some of the most motivated people to do practice that I've known and heard about have been prisoners. And they've probably gotten prison because they did something they shouldn't have done. And they probably didn't have enough ability to be present for themselves, have self-control, track what's going on. And so they feel it's really important to find those resources so we don't make the same mistake again. Sometimes it can be, you know, saying something to a friend. The little cliche is that, you know, it can take 20 years to create a really good friendship and one sentence to ruin it. One moment of, you know, being careless. This is last week, someone forwarded an email. I think it was for me, I guess. Someone who said that mostly she enjoyed my talk. She listens to my talk on the web. But that she was really disturbed by something I said. So I read what she said to say, and she quoted me back. And I said, you know, she's right. I really blew it. I shouldn't have said that. I was being careless. I was probably kind of flippant or too casual in this seat sitting up here, and I shouldn't have said that. And I felt, oh, there's a big responsibility sitting up here, and there's some danger. If I say the wrong thing, it hurts people, and causes problems, and so I need to be more attentive because of that sense of danger. Oh, I have to be a little more cautious here in what I do. Some people, the sense of possibility is really what inspires them. For some people, the sense of danger, which really gets them going. And for some people, it's both. For some people, the sense of danger is 9 parts out of 10. It's good enough. That's what just gets them going. And for some people, the idea of danger is 0 out of 10. That's not how they live their life. Maybe it's different personalities, different backgrounds. Who knows? Another thing that sustains practice over the long term is having support. Some people need a lot of support, and some people don't need much at all. For many people, when they try to practice alone, without support of other people, it's impossible. It's really hard. I would say that for myself, I could not have practiced alone. If I had read a book about practice and got the basic ideas and tried to practice on my own, I would not have been able to sustain it. I was really dependent on my teachers and my other friends who were practicing at the same time, carrying me along, encouraging me, giving feedback to me, inspiring me. So having support is really important. And one of the ways it's important is that as people begin to practice, sometimes their interests and values begin changing. And if their coworkers or family or friends don't change with them, it can create some dissonance. And you can start feeling like you're weird or strange, or feel like you don't have the courage to make that, to keep developing and changing yourself in the direction you feel is right, if it's going to make you so different from the other people. But then if you have other friends who are practicing, or a community like we have here, you realize that, either there are other people who are weird, and it's okay then. Or maybe you realize that maybe it's not so weird. Or maybe, you realize that, you're not alone, and you have the support, then it's easier to maintain it and sustain it. When I was living in monasteries, there was a whole, large group of people practicing together. And it was really powerful, the sense I had of being carried by the collective energy. People would get up early in the morning. We would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning sometimes for long periods and just get up and sit. And, practice throughout the day and go late in the night and sit. And, all this practicing going on in the monastery. And it was easy to do because, that's where the bus was going. That's what was going on. You get on that bus and that's where you go. You get on, you're there, and all these people around you are doing that, and they say, come along, and you the bells ring, and, it's really easy to be carried along. And, I don't feel like practicing today. I think I'll rest, Come on, let's go. The momentum is there. And then when I went to Asia to practice the first time, Thailand, I showed up at a little funky meditation monastery, temple, and I introduced myself to the abbot and said, I'm here and I want to learn whatever kind of meditation you're teaching. What should I do? He said, great, welcome. And he said, there's a little hut, one room, teeny little hut on stilts out on top of little swamps on the edge of the monastery. And you have to walk across these wooden planks across the kind of swamp up to this little hut. You go out there and you practice and come back and see me tomorrow. So I went out there and I was all alone. Practice, sit there. And I realized I'd never sat alone for any extended period of time. I'd done sits out for an hour or two at home. But to sit, 15 hours a day, sit and walk, do walking meditation for long periods of day alone, I'd never done that. And I'd always relied on the monastic kind of support that I got from all these group of people around me. By the time I got to Thailand, I'd done all this monastic practice. I had a certain amount of strength and momentum and discipline and capacity that I developed there in the monastery when I had the support of my friends. When I showed up to be alone in Thailand, I recognized this as being, oh, this is what comes now for me. Now I need to learn how to do this alone. I have to learn to have the motivation, the intention, the sense of importance on my own and without the group, without the support. And that means I need to look at myself, I have to develop those resources with myself. And that became extremely important. And then later, when I went back to Burma, to Southeast Asia the second time, I did a much longer retreat. And then, after about a couple of months into the long retreat, I was amazed how much my thoughts had to do with my old spiritual community where I used to live, the San Francisco Zen Center. And the people, the practices, the culture there had somehow burrowed itself deep into my psyche. And I was sitting there, half a world away, sitting there minding my own business. And I was still thinking about promotions at the Zen Center, getting a better job there and having conversations with my teachers and wanting to impress them, and I just couldn't believe it. This is amazing. So then part of the task there was, okay, to do this practice so I can become free of all those social concerns that I still carried with me. And I made a kind of commitment or a vow that I would not go back to the San Francisco Zen Center until I had Zen Center out of my psyche. And there's tremendous value in having support from other people, and it's tremendous value in practicing alone. And different times in their life, different things are necessary. Some people need a lot of support more than others. It's fine to get it. And I've known people who've come here to our group, and they would come to every sitting, every event we had here, and they just seem to need a lot of support. They need a lot of encouragement and a lot of it's okay and reassurance. And sometimes I felt I was kind of like babying them along. And now they grew up. They're grown. They're spiritual grown-ups. I'm just so happy that this place could be this. That was where they got that support when they were kind of spiritual babies. And now they're like not just grown-ups, like elders. And they don't need us anymore. They don't come anymore. They're off someplace else. But it's just so great to see that how things change and how it develops. So it's fine to get support if that's what allows you to sustain the practice over time. Then another thing which is important is having some wisdom, some understanding about the suitability of practice. And that's a strange term, suitability of practice. What practice is suitable? What's a suitable practice for you? So if you're overly idealistic, and I can remember sometimes I had these crazy ideas. I remember once flying back from Asia, and I'd been practicing in Japan and Southeast Asia, and I knew a lot about the monastic practice there, and I'd read this book about this marathon runners of Mount Hiei. You know about the marathon runners? And they run these marathons. They run, you know, all through the night and do all these. They're just, you know, great athletes. And their spiritual discipline practice for like 3 years is all this running around the temple, this huge mountain. And they carry a knife with them, because if they falter and fall, or they falter and stop, don't finish, you know, the run, then they're supposed to kill themselves. So that's one way of getting motivated and sustaining your practice. And so I remember reading, you know, reading all this stuff and being on the plane back to America and creating this list of, I was going to be the super yogi practitioner. I was going to get up earlier than everybody else, and I was going to, you know, do my running first, and I was going to, you know, and this and that. And, you know, it's kind of embarrassing to tell you. And you know how long I managed to follow my schedule? Not one day. I came back to America, and that big idealistic idea just never even actualized at all. And so you need to have some sense of, you know, balance, some sense of what's appropriate for the kind of life we live. And so that involves, you know, in terms of time, you know, what you do, the kind of practices you do, what the practice is most useful, and also how you live your life. So, for example, someone who has, like, for example, when my kids were really young, they're still kind of young, still a little bit an issue, but I used to get up every morning to sit. That was my thing to do for years and years and years. I would sit first thing in the morning, and I loved it. It was kind of like part of my life to do that. And then when I had these young kids at home, you know, we did get up early. You know, we got up at 1 o'clock, and then we got up again at 2 o'clock, and we got up at 3 o'clock, and then the 4 o'clock. And so then, you know, getting up at 5 o'clock to sit just, you know, didn't make sense. You know, then it was just asleep. And so it wasn't suitable, given that kind of life, to get up early in the morning and sit. So I found other ways to sit every day. I would sit later in the day, or sometimes I was opportunistic. I would sit, you know, I didn't, because the schedule was so variable, I would sit at different times. So to have a sense of what kind of practice is sustainable over time. If it's too idealistic, it's too ambitious, it's not going to work. So what is it that actually you can do and keep it up? Repetition, continuity is really important. So so what can you do continuously? What can you do repetitively day after day? And if you can't do half an hour meditation a day, if you say, I'm going to do half an hour every day, and you only get around to do it every fifth day, maybe you set yourself up too high a goal. Maybe if you set a goal 15 minutes a day, then you can actually do it every day. So what is it that allows you to maintain a regularity over and over and over again? Given the life you have, given the inspiration, the faith, the sense of purpose that you have for your life. And then it's useful to have what's called a toolbox, a toolkit, of different practices you might want to use, so that in different situations you can call forth different practices. If you only have one kind of practice, then it might not always be suitable given where your life is at. Sometimes maybe it's more useful to do loving kindness practice. Or sometimes, so when I, for example, when I was pushing my kid in a stroller sometimes, because, you know, you got to do it, you know, he wouldn't sleep or nap or whatever the reason was, I found that was a really great time to do loving kindness practice. And I would just love going for these walks in the stroller, and I would just run, have this running loving kindness phrases going through my mind, and I would think about all the different people I'd met that day, or anybody I could think of in my life, and send them loving kindness, sending my good thoughts and wishes. And I used to love, you know, stroller rides, and, you know, because I had that as a practice that I could do. And the greater range of practices that a person knows about, the more then in the corners of the day, in different situations you find yourself in the day, you can apply them and use them. If you only have one practice, maybe, you know, maybe it's, you know, like mindfulness is said to be applicable in all situations, but realistically, you know, maybe some things are more useful to do, or useful ways of practicing. Sometimes doing a concentration practice is helpful. Sometimes memorizing some text, like a spiritual text, and having that available and reciting it yourself is really helpful in different some circumstances. And the corollary of not being too idealistic, the opposite, is not being too not being idealistic enough, or not being being a little bit too lazy and complacent. To think, you know, that's sometimes also a way of getting discouraged or not having the practice be sustained. If you kind of think, well, yeah, I'll get around to it. I'll do a little bit here and there. I'll do some practice, and then it doesn't really go anywhere. And one of the ways it doesn't go, you don't feel any momentum building up, any strength or any change or any sense of growing calm or growing confidence or growing concentration or growing sense of mindfulness. If nothing begins happening, then you know you're going to slip off the path really easily. But if you have enough continuity and you're tracking yourself to see, oh, there is some kind of momentum building up here, then you're not so likely to get discouraged or give up because nothing's happening. So part of the value of regularity is to create momentum. Just like, you know, if you go to the gym or you exercise in some kind of way, that if you only exercise on January 1st every year, you know, you get discouraged after a while. But you got to do it kind of regularly in order to feel some of the benefits, and you can feel how they grow and how they over time as you kind of keep the exercise going. Same thing with meditation practice. It's kind of like exercise, and you feel the benefits as you do it. And as you feel the benefits themselves will feed back into the inspiration loop, feed back into the motivation loop, and make it easier and easier. Sometimes it's very hard for a period of time when a person's new, but then if you keep doing it, it becomes easier and easier. Sometimes just doing it every day, day in, day out, and not giving yourself any escape clause is really helpful, so that it becomes as commonplace as brushing your teeth. And I think that there's a lot of value, there's a lot of importance to developing a meditation practice on such a regular basis that it becomes like brushing your teeth. And part of the value is then the self-consciousness, the sense of that it's special falls away. It's just that easy. It's just what happens. And when the sense of specialness drops away, it's sometimes possible for the mind to settle much quicker and much more deep. As long as you think it's kind of special, the mind's a little bit excited. And kind of deeper levels of letting go can happen when you feel the meditation practice is nothing special. You just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. I'll try to be quick for my last point. You know, I realized when I was making these lists, there's no end to these lists of variables. So it's kind of arbitrary when you stop. Another thing that some people find is very helpful is to periodically go on retreat. Whether it's a one-day retreat like we have on Saturday, or it's a non-residential retreat like we have here a couple times a year, or it's a residential retreat, have some experience of going on retreat where you're practicing in a more sustained way throughout the day. Many people find that kind of jumpstarts their practice. And to do that periodically is kind of like getting a tune-up. You do that, and then you're good for a while. And then after a while, maybe your inspiration dries away, and you do it again, go on retreat, and it kind of keeps things going in a nice way. Three more things, very quickly, to kind of list. A thing that is very helpful in order to sustain practice over time is having a sense of integrity. And practicing with the precepts, practicing with your ethics, so that you feel like you live a clean life. A clean life, clean ethical life, sustains practice much more easy than an unclean ethical life. And then patience. Without patience, there's no spiritual life. You know, someone once said recently, I think Tan Jeff, you know, meditation requires 9 parts patience. You know, and 1 part something else. So patience is so important. And if you haven't learned it yet, you better learn it really soon, because otherwise you'll suffer. A lot of patience. And as I said in the beginning of the talk, meditation practice is inefficient. And it has all kinds of ups and downs. And you can be sure that there's going to be downs. There's going to be difficult times. and what sustains you through those difficult times. And one of those qualities can be, one of the variables can be patience. And then the last one, and not the least one, that can sustain a practice over time is a sense of love. And that's a very vague word, but a sense of deep joy, well-being, delight, kind of real appreciation for the practice, for oneself, for the spiritual dimension of life, and to feel that there's a that sense of kind of sense of spiritual love is present and available and close by. Some people get fed by that out of a sense of devotion, and they have the bhakti or orientation, kind of sense of devotional practice. Some people do devotional practices every day to feed and reveal and express the love they feel that's so deeply connected to, spiritual life. And so that really keeps the juices going, keeps the inspiration going to have that. There are periods when meditation becomes very dry, and at periods of time when I think there's going to be some great love. The love of spiritual life, I kind of like to think of it like a marriage. In that there's honeymoon phases, and there's times when it's really great, and sometimes it's just lousy. It's not working so well. But you're married, so you hang in there and you just kind of stay there and see it through. I don't know that many people who their marriage or their partnerships just kind of goes from better to better to better to better to better to better to better, better, just like in some linear way, right? Mm-hmm. They live happily ever after. Marriages can be quite trying at times. So when there's love and commitment in a spiritual life, spiritual practice, it's the same thing. What makes it really hard, though, is in that kind of life, spiritual practice, there's only really one partner, one person, it's you. So if you're having difficulty in the relationship, it's with you. So anyway, I hope that this has been helpful. I don't know if this was interesting even, but I was a little worried it was going to be boring going through a list like this. But I hope it gives you some idea that that spiritual life is sustained by many different variables. You don't need to have all the variables. You just need to have enough to get to 10 or whatever the number is in the spiritual world. I don't know. And look at your variables and see what needs to be adjusted and tuned and developed. If you want to have a strong practice, if that's your motivation, then see what needs to be tuned so you can have it. It's available to everyone. Thank you.